We have a double parsha this week, Naharan Bechukotai, and we'll see how much we cover. Maximum, we'll finish the parsha tomorrow night. Tomorrow night we have a late night with pizza. Parshat Behar begins with a focus on Shemitah. It's not too far away. 2 years from now, we're going to have Shemitah here in Israel again. We have a mitzvah that when we come into Israel and we settle down, so on the seventh year, the land goes fallow. That means we don't plant, we don't harvest, we don't deal with the field. Now, in an agrarian society, that means most people took off. So you have to ask yourself, what were they doing? They had no work all year. Today, we'll get to that. But they were supposed to take the year off. Everyone, slaves, servants, and so the Torah says everyone gets to eat from the food of the land, and this is really a declaration that God runs the show. You don't have a stronger declaration than that. God says no work, no work. And then every 50th year there's a jubilee year. On Yom Kippur we blow the shofar, and then we start our jubilee year, and suddenly all the servants go free, and all the land goes back to its original owner. And again, you have the 49th year is a Shemitah year, the 50th year is the jubilee year.
Why do they do that?
The Torah says to do it.
But what's
it's a reset button.
Oh.
It's like everything starts again. You get all the loans are annulled. All the properties go back to the original owner. All the Hebrew servants go out. You start from scratch.
Yeah, but a field could be sold 3 times in 50 years.
Right. So it still goes back to the original owner.
All the way back?
Yeah.
You have to find that guy?
He'll find you. the Torah gives us a warning that we should be fair in our business practices, because you could sell and not calculate how many years are left till Yovel. Torah says don't do that. The Torah repeats, don't afflict your fellow man. And from here we learn the biblical prohibition of afflicting with our words, a verbal abuse. You're not allowed to say anything that might hurt someone's feelings.
Which law is it?
Lotonu. The Torah repeats.
Cheating, not cheating.
So the fact that the Torah reiterates Lotonu teaches us you can't afflict it with words. The simple reading is don't afflict in business, don't cheat. The deeper meaning is the second time it's repeated is tells don't afflict verbally. And we will repeat what we're just running through the parasha, and then we'll look through it again just to get an overview, and then we'll go into more detail. The Torah says you follow this system and you'll live comfortably and confidently in the land. The land will bear its fruit. And I'll bless the land. We have fantastic stories, even this past Shemitah, where people who kept Shemitah saw the blessings with their own eyes. If you guys want to do a search, this past Shemitah, there was a cold spell. All the bananas went bad, except for the one who kept Shemitah. There was a specific field that kept Shemitah, and their bananas grew. You have a few stories, even from this past year's Shemitah. We have the famous story of, what's the name of the Moshav? Maybe Matityahu, I don't remember. When the first Shemitah we were in the state of Israel, there was a plague of locusts, and everyone's crops were destroyed, and the one crop that kept Shemitah were not destroyed. We have many stories in our history now, in the last 65 years of the state, where you could just look up online and see the stories. Today we already have pictures of some of the stories. I'm telling you, from this past Shemitah, we had phenomenal stories. We have a special mitzvah to buy land that our relative had to sell. Remember, land was owned based on the tribe. So families had properties that were close to one another. If your brother sold his field, you knew about it. And you have a special mitzvah to buy back that field. You didn't buy it back, it'll come back in Yovel. We have a special mitzvah within the cities that are walled, that are fortified, that you have 1 year to redeem property that was sold. And if you didn't, so then the property, the land goes over to the other person permanently. we have the Levite cities where they could redeem forever. It doesn't matter if it's walled or not. The Torah says if a person is faltering financially, help him out. My father always says on this pasuk that this is the midah of the Ribono Shel Olam. That what we say Hashem is Somech Nofelim. He supports those that are falling. The human approach is, if he falls, I'll help him out. If he needs charity, I'll give it to him. But when he's faltering and he's grasping, and if you help him now, then he won't go bankrupt. Sometimes he just needs a little bit leeway to make it out of a tight spot and his business won't go under. So then the human approach is far less apt to help. If you tell me you fell, I could help you. If you tell me you're falling, so we're less inclined to help. And that's where the Torah says, no, help him out. The Torah insists we are prohibited from taking interest. We're part of the club. It's called the Jewish club. And in the Jewish club, you don't collect interest and you don't pay interest. And this is a dual prohibition. It's prohibited to collect. It's prohibited to pay interest. And when we review the parsha, we'll discuss how banks work today and other things. Torah says, what happens if if a person goes bankrupt and then you buy him as a servant? So you have to treat him well. And we'll expand on that when we review the parsha again. And finally, the Torah says, what happens if a Jew sells himself to non-Jews? So again, you should redeem him. You don't want a situation where he can't keep Shabbos and Kashrus because he's owned by a non-Jew. He shouldn't have, you're right. We'll review the parsha and then try to add more depth to many of these points. And if we get to, we'll also go to Chukotai. Whatever the people want. I think Yosef was the one who shut it off and Yosef left. So whatever people here want. You guys decide. Is there anyone that does not want the air conditioning? You do not want it on? Or you don't? Is there anyone who does want it on? You want it on? Okay.
What?
We were discussing whether we should have the air conditioning on. Whatever you guys decide. What social system can work? We're going to see that the Torah over here developed a social system which will help most people, and the Torah also put in many clauses so that people would not remain unemployed and people would not take advantage of the system. One of the great difficulties Western civilization has today is that if you set up a social net, which is a great thing, so you have a lot of people who don't want to go out to work. So the Torah says, okay, you want to take advantage of the social structure? We see in our parsha where relatives have to bail you out. Well, it's not that you're a free man after they bailed you out. If one sold himself into slavery to a non-Jew, so then his brother, his uncle, everyone has a mitzvah to buy him back. But he's not a free man. He has to work the remaining years for them as their servant. The Torah doesn't say, oh, go free, go do what you want. You can sell yourself again, we'll bail you out again. No, you have a drinking problem, you have an addiction, you're selling yourself into slavery because you have a gambling issue. Okay, so we'll buy you out, fine. But then you're ours. You're not free to do your own thing. It's not that you can just bring everyone down with you. One of the big issues when people have addictions is that they bring everyone else down with them. People think, I'll just help them this time, I'll just help them that time. And these do-it-at-home cures don't work. People end up gambling their house away, gambling their savings away, putting the whole family into debt. And sometimes it could go even worse. People take a loan from a loan shark and then they owe them a favor. And because they owe them the favor, they end up doing all kinds of illegal things, and that's how they get sucked into the mafia. So there's a whole system out there of how to suck people in. There was a famous story, I don't know if I'm allowed to say which yeshuv, person was caught trafficking drugs. The Rav came to shul one Friday night, and he saw everyone's faces looked like Tisha B'Av. So he asked, what's going on? So they said, it was discovered that one of the members of the shul was trafficking drugs, and everyone was ready to kill him. And then they all told their kids, don't play with his kids and the works. So he went and he researched the story. And what happened was he had someone in his family had a certain medical issue. He couldn't get a loan. He ended up taking a loan from a loan shark. And then when he couldn't pay it up, the guy told him, okay, I can send Igor over and you'll lose both your legs. Or you can start just doing little errands for me. And that's how they cornered him, and the guy fell. No one's coming to justify what he did, but it's a different story than a guy who was trying to make a quick buck trafficking drugs. It was a different story, and it also said something about the community that didn't stand by him when he needed a loan, where he needed to end up going to a loan shark. I'm saying the story played itself out differently, and the Rav was fighting to get the guy accepted back in society and help him work his way out of where he was at that point. But I'm just coming to point out how difficult it is to set up a social system. And what the Torah is doing here is the Torah is saying, okay, you want to say you fell on hard times? You have a way out. You take a loan, you pay it back. The Shemitah year comes and you didn't pay it back, the Nol get... The loan gets absolved. Shukah. Our parsha begins with the concept of Shemitah. You're not going to work the field for 7 years, for a whole year, on the seventh year. How do we do Shemitah today, practically? So the Talmud says that we never kept Shemitah. It's a mitzvah we never really kept. Isn't that terrible? In all of Jewish history, we didn't do it. People didn't live up to it. Yeah. So the people in Yovel didn't let their servants go. And in Shemitah, they didn't let their land go fallow. And they kept their gates locked. And when we were exiled at the end of the period of the first temple, God says, now the land will finally rest because you didn't do it. You didn't do it. What does that mean? In Jewish history, this is a mitzvah we never kept.
Even in the best of times, Yahu, Shlomo Melech.
No, it's written 70 years. You know, there was a period. 70 Yovel.
There was a period where we were supposedly on quite a high level. And think that they would. You said somebody said someone said,
so now,
you asked me in Tzedakah, right? You're allowed. This is certainly an example where.
Right.
That you can be tested. And, you know, I mean, I imagine that they, the Lord, because they didn't have the confidence that they would keep.
It's very yeah.
Amazing.
It's understandable.
But when you talk about the things that they did do and the levels, they left everything in one place. It all went down to the pilgrimages and things weren't wrecked and stolen, robbed. I mean, you know.
They built a temple.
You know, at the level they were at.
So, it's a good question. Let's leave it for now. The Talmud says we set up a system. What the courts did was the courts would come in and take over people's fields, collect all the food because they saw there was too much corruption going on, and then the courts would set up their own centers which would distribute food daily. So the court-appointed messengers would come and collect the food from the field, and then the court, being representative of the people, would give out the food. And this is already mentioned in the Tosefta, in Tanaic times. And Nachmanides in our Parsha quotes this as well. And so today, we have this too, where you have fields where the owner is very limited in what he can do. I mean, he can only do things that will prevent the field from getting destroyed. He can't really support the field. The Gemara makes a distinction between Avruye Ilane and Stume Pile. Two types of, let's say, watering, two types of supports where you can't support it to be productive, you can prevent damage from the field. And the courts will appoint people, very often the same farmer who worked the field until now, will be appointed with exact directions what he's supposed to do. And then when harvest time comes, the court will send them in and they'll collect all the fruits and bring them into a storage house, and then the court sends out to different locations, it's usually not in stores, where they will put the food up for sale. For example, we buy grape juice from the courts. We buy grape juice from them. You can get a whole crate of grape juice, like 12 bottles, for 100 shekel or 90 shekel. It's much cheaper than the regular grape juice you're going to get. When you buy bananas, you don't buy it by the kilo. You buy a box full of bananas or a cluster of bananas. You buy them for a global rate. And the idea is we're not allowed to do business with the fruits of Shemitah. On the other hand, why am I paying? I'm covering the costs of the court. Meaning the court is there, the Beis Din is there, Beis Din is the court, the Beis Din is there to represent the people in giving out the free food. But the Beis Din is allowed to collect money to cover their costs. So the way they do it is they have different homes in the neighborhoods or different locations where they'll show up on a given day. And it's called Otsar Beis Din, the storage house of the court. And they don't sell it by the kilo, because you're not allowed to do business with the fruits of Shemitah, but rather they sell it in a more generic and a more general way. So you buy a crate of apples, it costs you a global amount. Then you're not allowed to pick among the apples and say, oh, I'll switch this for that and do the other. The whole idea is we're not doing business here. You're covering the cost of what this crate cost. And what?
The poor doesn't have even that money.
So that's a problem. You're right. That's a problem. That's a problem. We don't really cover that. They're left out, right?
I mean, even to come with the bus up to there, it happened.
That's true. That's a problem. Now, the fruit that you buy that's Otsar Beis Din is holy with the holiness of Shemitah. Now, what does that mean? The Torah says, eat the fruits and let the animals eat the fruits. So that teaches us a few halachos. One halacha teaches me is that whatever's edible by me, I'm not allowed to give to the animal. I'm not supposed to give him my apple. I'm not supposed to destroy the fruit of Shemitah. So that means, let's say let's take the way a classical home runs. You're washing dishes, you get up in the morning, and you see that the drain is still clogged. The filter on the drain is clogged from yesterday's dishes. Now, all that tomato sauce and spaghetti and cottage cheese is rotten, right? It's not edible. You put it in the garbage. Now, you eat an apple, and you don't finish the apple down to the core. You throw that in the garbage. Now, the apple gets mixed with the rotten, what's already rotten from last night, tomato sauce, spaghetti, cottage cheese that's rotten, right? You're basically destroying the apple by throwing it into the tomato sauce, right? Into the rotten tomato sauce. That's not permissible with Shemitah fruit. So when we run a Shemitah house, we have a special garbage called Pach Shemitah, the Shemitah garbage, which the idea of the garbage is that when you're going to eat an apple of Shemitah fruit, whatever you don't finish from the apple, you put it in that bag. But at the end of the day, you close off that bag, and tomorrow you start a new bag because you don't want to cause fruit to become rotten. So you might say, I don't want to eat every part of my cucumber. I peel my cucumbers, but the peel is edible. Most people in Israel eat their cucumber peel. So the peel of the cucumber goes in a special bag. You're not allowed to just toss it in the garbage, get it mixed there. Now, you can't throw it in the garbage where they'll throw it into the incinerator until it's rotten. Once it's rotten, it goes into the garbage. So what we do in Shemitah is we run, it sounds complicated, but it isn't. You just get into the habit. Even my little kids were in the habit, where every day we open a new bag, and at the end of the day, we close up that bag and tie it. We leave it on the side, and when it becomes rotten, we toss it into the garbage, eventually to be taken out to the general garbage. So it just takes a little bit of habit. Now, it gets more difficult when you have little children. You give a kid a banana, he eats three bites and says, I don't want, boom. Now what? That's still edible. What am I supposed to do there? I don't want to eat it. Okay, so I could put it in a bag and leave it on the side. And when it rots, that's not my fault. I didn't do anything. If I'm a big, brave person, I could eat the rest of the banana. And I have a mitzvah because I ate the Shemitah fruit. But I don't have to. But we try not to let kids waste the Shemitah fruit. Because Shemitah fruit is holy. You're not supposed to let it go to waste. So an interesting example is in Havdalah. We don't let the grape juice overflow in Shemitah. because you're not allowed to let the food go to waste. So we're more careful that not a drop goes to waste when within we do it within the confines of normal of running a normal house.
Can combine fruit from Jordan from outside of Israel with fruit from.
Okay, so in Shemitah year you have four things which you can buy. You have Otzer Bezdin. We just described where the fruit is holy. It grew in Israel. It was taken over by a court. And that's one, and that's the best thing you can do. That's the best thing you can buy. Then you have another three options. You can buy fruit that had Heter Mechira. There was a Heter that was devised about 600 years ago, 700 years ago, when the Jews came back in the time of Rav Yosef Karo already. There was a discussion of this concept of selling the land to a non-Jew for the year and then growing the fruit there. It's a very difficult Heter. It was already invented 600 years ago, but there are many problems with it. It's not permissible to sell land in Israel to a non-Jew. There's a prohibition to sell land to a non-Jew. And there are other difficulties with it. And till today, the Rabbanut does Heter Mechira. And Rav Kook, even though he didn't like the Heter Mechira, but this was probably the most controversial thing he ever did, was that he permitted it because he saw there was no choice. And he himself writes that he's not happy about it and that it's not the best route we can go. But for lack of a better option, that was a route which he instituted. And the Rabbanut till today does that with many farmers, where technically the field belongs to a non-Jew during Shemitah. There is a machloket between Rav Yosef Karo and the Mabit. There was a machloket back in the days of Rav Yosef Karo, whether land that's owned by a non-Jew, is that even absolved from Shemitah? Who says that the fruit isn't holy? So that's a separate discussion. And there's a machloket between Jerusalem and Bnei Brak, who we go by, meaning there's two different customs, how we view Yevul Nochri, what we call non-Jewish fruit. So there's Yevul Nochri, non-Jewish fruit, that was not sold in the Heter Mechira. A non-Jew owns a farm in Israel. That's Yevul Nochri. And then you have the Heter Mechira. Aside from that, you have fruit that's brought in from Chutz Laaretz, what you just mentioned. And that's divided really into two and maybe even three subcategories. Where in southern Israel, Gush Katif and other areas, what's called the Arava, the south, there are areas which are not included in the biblical Israel, and so they don't have holiness. So you have Jewish-grown fruits and vegetables from the south, which do not have the holiness of Shemitah. Then you have, so that's technically Chutz Laaretz, right? Eilat. Technically that's Chutz Laaretz.
So
It's a discussion exactly where the line is, but there are places in the south which we consider that they do not have the holiness of Shemitah. So that's one type of fruit and vegetable you could buy from Chutz Laaretz. So that's great. Then you have a second type, which is the fruit that's brought in from the Palestinians. I never let my kids eat that. The Palestinians make a mint. Some farmers live for 6 years off the profit they make in Shemitah. People ask me, how do you manage? I say, we live on legumes. You have rice, you have beans, you have corn, you have so many canned goods, and you have so much food. Until Sukkot, you're fine. You still have fruit from last year. The issue is from Sukkot till next year, Sukkot. Okay, so I have 1 year where my kids don't eat tomatoes and cucumbers. Nothing happens. You don't die from not eating tomatoes and cucumbers. All winter long, you still have oranges and apples from last year. So they have fruits from last year. The fruit's last. That's not a problem. I'm saying the store will still sell you last year's fruit. What you're buying in the winter is still fruits from last year. All the fruits. So it's only when you hit Pesach that you suddenly have an issue where the fruits start becoming Shemitah fruits, and the vegetables, since Sukkot, are already Shemitah vegetables. So your challenge is really from Pesach until Rosh Hashanah. Until Pesach, you still have a lot of good fruits. Pesach time, you start running out of apples and oranges and all that. So from Pesach to Sukkot, my kids eat a lot of crackers and rice and pasta and tomato. You got ketchup and tomato paste. It's not like Pesach. You have so much more food. They're not hungry. How much vegetables does an average kid eat on an average week? I'm saying, aside from that, we Otzer Bezdin, you don't have vegetables. Because if you're not planting, Otzer Bezdin doesn't allow you to plant. Otzer Bezdin collects what grows. So we get, what we get is, and that's the last kind, and that is they bring in from Holland. They bring in peppers from Holland, and they bring in from Chutzlartz, not from the Arabs that are trying to kill us. They bring from further out, they bring in vegetables, and that costs an arm and a leg. Saying, if you want to try to buy that, that's really vegetables that are imported from Europe. That's very expensive. But we do that sometimes. Some things aren't too expensive, and we do that. So that's one summer where the kids aren't eating watermelon. Big deal. Saying there's so much other food to eat. We're spoiled. We live in a spoiled time. I'm saying some of my kids eat pasta, and their chicken you can eat, and meat you can eat, and soy you can eat. There's a ton of food to eat. And again, you have rice and you have legumes. So they eat corn, canned corn. They eat a lot of canned corn and peas and other stuff. They're not missing anything. I'm saying, and it's all 6 months. You're not really talking about a long period of time. It's not such a big deal. I don't know. I don't see any reason that people...
How will be the next Shemitah in 2014? How will be?
What do you mean?
I mean, people will start to keep Shemitah in Eretz and doesn't talk the land and doesn't...
I don't know. I don't see any reason it should be different than it's been until now. We have a lot of mitzvahs to go through. This was just an overview of practical. How do we practically keep Shemitah here? But let's move forward because we have a lot to do still. There's an interesting machloket between the Rambam and the Ravid, the Rambam and the Gaonim. When we count the 50 years, is year number 50, does it count also as year number 1? So that's, or is it a separate year? Right. So that's a machloket. It's a machloket in the Mishnah, it's a machloket in the Gemara, it's a machloket in Halacha. And so we really have two counts, technically. We count it as its own year, meaning it's a 50-year cycle. But there is an opinion which says you count 49, and year number 50 is also year number 1. So it's a 49-year cycle.
Yeah.
That's a machloket. Does year 50 stand on its own, and after that comes year number 1 of the 7-year cycle? Or is year 50 also year number 1 of the 7-year cycle? So that's a discussion.
Until now, doesn't keep nobody the 50 years.
Right, because the mitzvah of Yovel is when Am Yisrael is here, when all the tribes are here. We don't have everyone here yet. Then we have the mitzvah of Yovel, the Jubilee year, the 50th year. Comes Rosh Hashanah of the Jubilee year, and all the servants are waiting on Yom Kippur. They'll blow shofar, they go home. But from Rosh Hashanah, they don't have to do any work. So they get a 10-day vacation where they're living off the master, and they get to eat and drink, and they get everything they want, and they don't have to do work. So they end their servant period, their servitude, they end with a 10-day vacation, during which time the owner has a mitzvah to give them as many gifts as he can. So that's called ha'anaka. The Torah says ha'anik ta'anik lo. Give him, you benefited. He worked for you. Give him, this is the concept of a bonus. You made a good profit off of him. Let him enjoy from it too. So you have a mitzvah to give him gifts at the end of the year when he's going to go free. And then at the end of those 10 days on Yom Kippur, the Beis Din blows shofar and then the slaves go free. Why is it called Yovel? So Yovel is a shofar. Many of the laws of blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah are actually derived from the psukim about blowing shofar on Yom Kippur, because the Torah tells us that they're identical. They would blow the same way we blow on Rosh Hashanah, they would blow on Yom Kippur. And the simple reading is that it's called Yovel because Yovel is a shofar. Yovel also means to be led. Everyone is led back home. The servant goes back home, all the properties come back to their original owners. So that's the idea of Yovel, the 50th year. The Torah tells us, Al tonu ish et achiv. Do not afflict your fellow man. What does that mean? So the simple reading is, be fair. You live here in Israel, a bag of milk costs 5 shekel. A guy comes off the plane, he's a new Olet, he comes in all excited. He comes into the makolet and he says, "Ani olacha da'asham me'artzos habris. Kama ole sakis shel chalavim. So you say, oh, a bag of milk? No problem, chap. That'll be five. He pulls out a $5 bill and puts it on the counter. You say, perfect, you got exact change. You pocket the $5. You don't tell him it was five shekel. You give him the bag of milk and say, come back here tomorrow. Maybe we'll give you a discount. He walks out all happy. He's made his first friend, the makolet owner. He doesn't know you ripped him off. 2 weeks later, he suddenly discovers it's supposed to be five shekel and not $5. He comes back and he says to you, hey, buddy, you know, I've been paying you $5 every day for a bag of milk. It's supposed to be five shekel. Everywhere else in the country, it's five shekel. My neighbor just told me. And you look at him and say, you ingrate. I've been having to schlep out and find a money changer who will accept your filthy bills. I do you this nice service, and this is how you say thank you to me? Comes the Torah and says that's a biblical prohibition, right? You guys have probably encountered this. I sat on a taxi where the guy paid the fare in dollars, and the taxi driver didn't say a word. The Torah says, Al tonu, don't be unfair. You could be the buyer and you could be the seller and you could be unfair. It could go both ways. But that's when there's a market value, when there's a clear market value. Certain things don't have a clear market value. Real estate is one of them. Real estate, there's a huge range of prices that are fair. You know, the two guys here are renting apartments. And you speak to guys, you see, the same size apartment, the same benefits can run for $500 and $1,000. There's a huge range, even in this neighborhood. And so we have a concept, Einon Abikar Kot. When it comes to land, there's no such thing as affliction. Land that you buy, that land can go for any price. Do your homework. There has to be a market price. That's why I took something which is government ordained. The price of milk is decided by the government. Milk and bread, the basic things here in Israel, the government tells them what price to take on it. So that's where you have a prohibition, al tonu, when there's a set price. Certain things have a set price. So that's where the buyer and the seller have a prohibition, not to be unfair. You're allowed to take up to a sixth of profit above the market price. That's okay. One-sixth is okay. You're allowed to make a deal where you benefit one-sixth of the market, but not more than that. Yes?
What about with regards to taxi drivers? What is their limitations if you're not using the meter? Or maybe even there's ways to cheat with the meter if you're the rider or the driver. What are the limitations of taxi drivers? So they have a tourist who's paying. That'll be $25, and they give you $25 instead of 25 shekels.
So that's not fair.
Yeah. So okay, fine. But then what's the difference between that and real estate? Because there's no market price on the taxi ride.
Yes, there is.
What, the meter?
More or less, yeah. They will usually give you a price that's higher than the meter. Because whenever they offer you a price, you should go with the meter. It's rare that you'll benefit. You might sit in traffic. They have to factor that they might sit in traffic. So if a metered fare usually comes out to 30 shekel, they'll tell you 35 or 40. They're prepared for you to haggle. This way they can go down. And they want to cover themselves in case there's traffic. They know the times of day. They know more than you do. I don't go in a taxi unless it's a route that I've done before and I know the price. I won't go for a set price. And I was born in Israel and I've been here for almost two decades now. I always take the meter. And I have a few reasons. Number one, this way I'm not helping him cheat the government. I'm not interested in helping him cheat and not pay taxes on this money. Number two, I don't know if he's trying to rip me off. And number three, if we do get stuck in traffic, so he also has to make a living. So I'll end up paying more, and that's also fair. So in all directions, the meter, I think, is the way to go. They don't like it. The only time it's worthwhile to go with a set rate is when you have bags with you. If you have luggage, so then on a metered rate, they'll charge you per bag, and that could end up being a lot of money. But Usually it's not worth it. Unless you have that. If you have three people, again, they'll charge you with the meter more. But now the Torah repeats and says, "V'lo tonu ish et amito," don't afflict your fellow man. And here the Torah wanted us to be extra sensitive to someone's feelings. The classical example that the Talmud gives is that you walk into a store and you have no intention of buying anything. And you start driving the store owner crazy. How much is this? And how much is that? And what's this made out of? Do you really plan on buying anything? If you know you're not going to buy anything, so then it's wrong. You're not allowed to take his time. Sometimes you're not sure. You walk into a farm store and you start looking around. You might buy something. That's okay. You walk into a souvenir shop. You might buy something. That's okay. Sometimes before you heard the price, you were going to buy it. I went to a jewelry store. I asked, "How much is that?" So I thought it said $10.90. It said $1,090. It was a, you know, okay. So no, this isn't the price range I'm looking for. Okay, now I know. But so long as you're being honest, that's okay. Chazal said, even to that degree, Chazal said this prohibition, lo tonu ish et amito, is especially potent when it comes to one's wife. Chazal said that being that women tear more easily, they cry more easily, that's an indication that they feel more deeply. That where if we'd say something to someone, to another guy, they would brush it off. A woman can burst into tears. And Chazal said that teaches us how deeply they feel. So the application of lo tonu ish et amito, don't afflict a fellow man, Chazal say, is even more potent with regard to one's wife. And Chazal have a whole page in Talmud discussing the weight of this prohibition. Chazal say, Sha'rei ona'a eina ninalin. The gates in heaven of affliction never get sealed. When a person is afflicted and he cries, so in heaven that has weight like the biggest tzaddik we're davening. And the Gemara gives us a bunch of stories. One of the famous stories the Talmud gives us is Tanuro shel Achnai. The famous Machlokas Rabbi Eliezer and the sages about a special oven, whether it's defiled or not. And the rabbis all ruled it's defiled. And Rabbi Eliezer said it's pure. And the rabbis said, "You're arguing too much." He kept bringing proofs. And they said, "You should give in." All the rabbis are against you. He didn't give in. So they ostracized him. So the rabbis all agreed to ostracize him, right? But Rabbi Eliezer was hurt. So the Talmud says when Rabbi Eliezer said Tachanun, the chief rabbi who ruled to ostracize him dropped dead. But he was right. Allah was with him, right? But he hurt someone's feelings. It's not enough that you're right. See, a phenomenal concept in the Gemara. So, lo tonu ish et amito, the Talmud spends a whole page giving you story after story and warning after warning. Special prohibition to be careful not to say something that'll hurt someone else's feelings.